Are made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting the North American premiere of Enescu's opera Oedipus on Saturday, October 15th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. More information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and at the controls, Henry Frayne. This is hour number two of our program. And in this hour, we'll be talking about education reform, something that certainly we have discussed many times before on this show over the years with many different guests. And this morning, we'll be talking with someone who, at least in some people's minds, is a somewhat controversial figure in the whole area of education and school reform. His name is Chris Whittle. He was the owner of Esquire magazine, more importantly, the founder of Whittle Communications and Channel One, and he conceived and founded the Edison Schools, which now serves more than 270,000 students in 20 states in two countries. It is the nation's largest for-profit manager of public schools. He has been a critic of public education for some time now, and says clearly that American education has left many children behind, pointing out that something like 15 million kids in the United States are below basic literacy levels. At the same time, he strongly believes that public schools here in the United States can become the best in the world, and lays out some of his ideas in a newly published book, which is titled Crash Course, Imagining a Better Future for Public Education. It's published by Riverhead Books and is in bookstores now. If you would like to read it, and questions are welcome, too. We welcome questions, comments from people who are listening. The only thing we ask is people try to be brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many as possible. But anyone listening is welcome to call questions or comments. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means anywhere you're listening around Illinois and Indiana or anywhere in the United States, if you would happen to be listening on the internet, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Whittle, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks for having me.
Certainly now, over the past couple of decades in this country, we have talked a lot about school reform. Lots of ink has been spilled. A lot of people have laid out ideas and made proposals. And it seems that periodically something comes along that seems to be the magic bullet of the moment. And right at the moment, it seems that one of those certainly is the charter school. But at the same time, even though we've been talking about it a lot and people have put out a lot of ideas and indeed reforms have been instituted, there is still the general feeling that students in this country do not perform as they should and the schools aren't providing the quality of education we would like. So I guess that's a place we could start is by asking a question. I realize it's a big one, but why is it that given that we've done all of this talking about reform and tried to do some, that we haven't had more success?
It's a great question, and in a sentence, I would say, as a nation, we haven't figured out how to scale excellence in our schools. We have thousands of excellent public schools, tens of thousands of excellent public schools in the United States, and by the way, everyone knows that. You know, wide numbers of parents are thrilled with what's happening with their children in their school. So it's not that we don't have great public schools. The problem is a stone's throw away from many of them or a few miles away from many of them. We have public schools that you wouldn't want to send your children to. And what we have failed as a nation to do is to figure out how to scale and sustain excellent schools. And another way to say it is we have a consistency problem. We have 90,000 public schools in the United States. 50 or 60,000 of those are either good or excellent. The problem is that we have 20 or 30,000 public schools that are in deep trouble. And we have 15 million illiterate children in the United States. That's more children than England has children.
Certainly what you point to is the case, and we would never want to say that there are no good public schools in the United States, because clearly that's that's not right. There are some very fine public schools. I guess that when you reach for an explanation, though, the first thing you'd have to point to is the fact that some communities are very highly advantaged and some are not. And here, for example, in the state of Illinois, there's an enormous difference in the amount of resources that individual districts, because of the wealth of the places where they're located, have to put behind their kids, and that the efforts of state government to try to equalize those differences have not been terribly successful. How much of this simply has to do with resources in a dollar and cents kind of a way?
I'm not ducking this answer because it's not an easy answer. The answer is sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And example, there are states who have done a pretty good job of actually making resources equitable, and yet they still see this consistency issue. Overall in the United States, for 30 years, we have been raising education spending at substantially above the rate of inflation, but our illiteracy rate as a nation has basically remained the same for two decades. So if spending alone were the issue, we should have seen some impact on the number of illiterate children, and we really haven't. But we're seeing a bit of improvement in recent years, but it's small compared to the problem. And to say it another way, I could take you to cities that are spending $12,000 a year per pupil. And who just aren't getting the results. The national average is about $8,000 per pupil per year. But there are some cities that spend way beyond that, and they're not getting what they need. So it's not just funding. Let me go just a little bit further. I think we often hide behind the funding issue because the other issues are hard to deal with. In my book, what I'm saying is what we need is the next generation of schools, and that we have a school design. And when I say school design, I mean everything that goes on in a school. We have a school design that's over 100 years old. It's not modern. It doesn't work in the current context nearly as well as it should.
Well, let me go to that point in just a moment, but just to return to the resources issue, one thing I do know that is true is you do believe that we should and must increase pay for teachers. We need to pay teachers more than we do now.
Absolutely. Did I cut you off there?
No.
Okay. The average American teacher makes $46,000 a year. In my book, I say that for the average teacher, we need to double that, and for our best teachers, we need to triple it. And what I'm saying is we need to make teaching competitive with other professions, and we cannot rely on what we currently have today, which is we're asking teachers to be philanthropists. And many of them do that for many years, and we're deeply in their debt. But lots of people just can't do it. And at some point, teachers have to worry about their own families, and they have to go seek jobs that do pay them. And we're not going to be able to fill 3 million teaching posts with the quality teachers we need paying $46,000.
Our guest, Chris Whittle, he conceived and founded the Edison Schools. It is the nation's largest for-profit manager of public schools. They have students in 20 states, more than 270,000 of them. He's laid out some of his ideas for improving public education in a book that's recently come out. The title is Crash Course, Imagining a Better Future for Public Education. Riverhead Books is the publisher. Questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about school design, because you've said, and I'm sure that you would agree if you have highly committed teachers and highly motivated students, that even if you have things working against you, you can have student performance, but that wouldn't necessarily be an optimum. I mean, you can have a bad atmosphere, and that's not the best. So if you're arguing for some kind of way, a new way of organizing design as being an engine that will improve student performance, what is it that you're talking about?
I lay out many different ideas in the book, but let's take one that we were touching on a moment ago, which is highly paid teachers. If we're going to double teacher pay in America, how are we going to do that? My position is we can't do it through tax increases. Legislatures all across the country have already given us their answer on that. They haven't done it for 20 years. They've done it somewhat, but they're not going to do it at anywhere near the radical increases that we need to do. And the reason is it just hits taxpayers too hard. If we doubled teacher pay in the U.S., it would cost every household in the United States between $1,000 and $1,500 of additional taxes every year. It's not going to happen. So what we've got to do is we've got to say, well, then how do we do it? And in the book, I give one answer and say we ought to go try this and see if it works. And the answer that I propose is that let's have half as many teachers and pay them twice as much. And we have 3 million teachers in the United States. Let's say we had 1.5 million and we double pay. Now, many of your listeners are, many questions are running through their mind right now. Some may go, well, did he just double class size?
Yeah, exactly. That was my question there.
Okay.
Exactly, yeah.
And the answer is, no, I didn't, because there's another way to do that. You can have half as many classes, and class size remains the same, but instead of 6 classes a day, which is what a typical student has today, what if they had 3 classes a day, and then the other 3 class periods, they're working on their own in school? And just to let you know, I'm talking about really middle and high schools on this particular idea. And now your listeners are going, but students can't work on their own. They have to be forced to learn. They've got to be constantly supervised by adults. They're not motivated in the way they should. They would be doing all sorts of things we don't want them to do if they were on their own. And I have multiple answers to that. The first one is, if you look at a college freshman is 90 days older than a high school senior, just 90 days. A college freshman is in class 11 hours a week. A high school senior is in class 30 hours a week. What happened in 90 days? What happened was colleges have a different design, and it's a design where they go, we are going to have less classes. We're going to have terrific teachers in those less classes, and we are going to depend on students to be able to do a lot of work on their own. And, by the way, they don't even supervise them during that that period of time. They just assume they're going to do it. Now, half of all of our college seniors, or excuse me, half of all of our high school seniors go on to college. So a lot of people would say, yeah, but that's only college students. Well, that's half of our high school seniors. And if we took a page from the way we design our colleges and said we're going to start moving towards that, you don't have to go there all at once, in our high schools and our middle schools, we could dramatically increase teacher pay.
Look, I have a couple of callers here, and I promise these people I'll get right to them. Just let me follow up on that just a second, because as you say,
it's an important part of the idea.
When you first lay out that idea, in my mind there was the question. I know in other people's minds the question. They're suddenly saying, "Now wait a minute, you're talking about dramatically changing the student teacher ratio,"
and which I'm not.
One of the sort of articles of faith for all along now has been smaller class size, good. You know, fewer students per teacher, good thing. Now, and I know you're saying, well, that's not doubling class size, but at the same time, I can't imagine, though, the student-teacher ratio is still going to be changed, and I just can't help but feel that that is going to mean that the workload of the teachers is going to go up.
No, it's really saying that the amount of time that a student is in a formal class is going to be cut in half. That's what it's saying. And but I know you want to go to a caller, and we can come back to that because we should. Okay.
Okay. Well. All right, we'll do that. We'll come back to that. And I have some callers, and I try not to make people wait too long. So okay. Let's do that. We'll go to nearby community, St. Joe, line one, to start us off here. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I was curious about your views on student discipline and teacher safety, because I know a lot of people have gotten out of teaching just because they don't feel safe in the classrooms. And is it all because parents aren't doing what they need to be doing? And what do you do with the student that doesn't want to be there at all?
Student safety and more broadly defined, what we call the learning environment, which is, you know, the whole culture and feeling of a school, is a critical part of a successful school. And one thing that we believe is the best discipline program in a school is a good reading program. And what I specifically mean by that is if you have failed as a school to teach a child to read, they are going to be a discipline problem. And the reason is if you have a 13-year-old in a science class that cannot read, they do what, frankly, we would do if we were in that situation, which is they act out. They have so much frustration about their situation. It's completely understandable that they do what they do. And our failure then really isn't our discipline system. The failure is that we let them get into that situation as a child. And the failure often occurred in the first, the second, and the third grade. I was reading last night something that, and I may not quote it perfectly, but close enough. It was literally that a child's vocabulary in the second grade is a very substantial predictor of how they will do in high school. So if you don't have a certain level of vocabulary by the second grade, it's a substantial indicator of where you'll be in high school.
Okay. What about the discipline issue? And particularly the issue the caller raises about concerns that there are real concerns that teachers have in some places about their security and their safety.
Yeah. Schools all over the United States are dealing with this issue, and I'll just reiterate what I said. The best discipline systems are extremely well-prepared children from elementary schools. If they are literate and they can compute and they can learn, they're not going to be discipline problems in middle high schools. If they're not, they're going to be very substantial issues and are. And then you're faced with having to do things, and I'm not saying they're wrong, like no tolerance policies on all sorts of issues. But that's kind of dealing with the symptom, and what we really need to be doing is dealing with the cause and making sure that those children don't ever arrive in those circumstances.
Okay, let's talk with someone in Indiana. This is line number four. Hello.
Hello. I taught in the public school system, but was never an ordained teacher, let's put it that way. I used my college for what here in Indiana is called emergency teaching, and also down in North Carolina. Anecdotally, the first time you mentioned about we ought to increase teacher salaries double, I was wondering what the teachers in your Edison schools get paid, for example. You know, what you preach, is that what you sow, so to speak? Secondly, this is such an immense thing, it just, you know, out of 1,000 questions one could ask, I'll just throw out one. And this comes from something I remember as a child. I had buddies back when I was in grade school who could give you batting averages, fielding averages, you know, anything had to do with baseball, just, you know, like that. But when it come to the schoolwork, I don't know where they weren't interested or whether or not the family pushed them or what it was, but they were certainly naturally able to do things. But somehow they didn't do it in the school system. And when I first ran across those children when I was in the public school system, I had a hell of a time trying to get their minds around to why what they were learning now was important for their, you know, later life and future. And many, many times when I got to talking to them, I discovered that they spent most of their time away from school, besides playing with friends and stuff, was watching that old tube. And I got to the place where I thought to myself, what I'm battling is you know, I'm up against advertisers in the long run of trying to get their attention and in a sense their allegiance. And I just wondered if you had anything to say about that. And in terms of, in Indiana, the charter schools we have here, which I don't know a heck of a lot about, but when things are talked about, some of them are, or people get tested well and some of them tested poorly, and there wasn't too much correlation one way or the other between one school versus the other, except the charter schools usually were much smaller, so that in a sense they could give more time per, you know, per unit student to help them in their progress. I was wondering if you could speak to those concerns. Thanks.
I think there were three. One was charter school performance in Indiana. Two was what we actually do at Edison Schools on teacher pay. And three was what I thought was your most important question, which is the whole question of how do you actually engage children in schools. And I think it's that question is central to the whole question of new types of schools in the future. One of the things that they have to be extremely good at is how they engage their students and how they motivate their students on learning. And I, let me just start here on this topic. I think public schools in America, on this particular issue, which is the idea of student motivation, that we, and I include Edison in this, we've missed the boat terribly on this issue. And I was in Philadelphia the other day, and I was sitting with a teacher at a lunch, and I said, "What's the biggest problem you have every day?" And they said, "A loss of hope." And I said, "You mean your hope?" And she said, "No, that my children have lost hope." And I talked to her the rest of lunch about what she exactly meant by that. And what she was saying is that the children in her school didn't see where this all led to. They looked at school and they went, you know, if I do well, what difference is it going to make? And they could not connect their school experience to how that might actually alter their prospects towards happiness and prosperity in the future. That is a school's job, is to make that an easy connection for students, where they can see what today's math class has to do with their future, what today's history class has to do with their future. And we can't leave that, school designers can't leave that to chance. We've got to go every day, how are we going to help students see the why of what we're doing? Because if we don't, we're going to lose them. And just a little test for listeners that just shows you how true this is. We have many schools we're involved in that are K-12 schools. They start at kindergarten and they go all the way through high school. I can walk into a kindergarten class. There's enormous natural energy on the children's part. They're just kind of thrilled to be there. It's new. They're engaged. And they're learning. You then go to a middle school class in that same school. You see a drop in the energy level. Students aren't leaning forward, they're leaning back. You then move to a high school class, and it's even more extreme. And that issue of a kind of loss of engagement is a crucial issue in school design of the future. Just to answer the caller's other two questions, Edison teachers make roughly what teachers do in the communities where our schools are. And another way to say that is we're not using some of the design ideas that I'm advocating, and the reason I wrote the book is not only do I want us to start thinking about these, but I was trying to offer these ideas to all schools, and we are working on how we may incorporate them. And then the final idea on charter school performance in Indiana. I was actually in Indianapolis last week. We're associated with a school there called Crystal House Academy. They do absolutely terrific work and have gain rates that are much higher than both state and city norms. But to the reader's point, there are charters, just like any other public schools, that are not performing as they should. The good news is charters that don't perform get shut down. And too often public schools that don't perform do not.
Hmm. Well, that gets to this issue, and I think I mentioned at the beginning of the program that currently and for some years now, there are a lot of people have been really high on the idea of the charter school as a method of improving public education, and that for a long time there was no way to answer this question if we compare students who are comparable in a conventional public school and in a charter school, do the charter school students really do better? It seems like for a long time there was no way to answer that question, but recently we have started to get some answers, and overall the answer seems to be no. In fact, that the kids in the charter schools don't do better. Now there may be individual schools that you can point to that have been very successful, but as an overall way of answering that question, are charter schools better? It seems the answer is no, they're not.
I would challenge that. Okay.
Okay.
First of all, full disclosure: we are the largest charter school operator in the United States. So let's disclose that I have a vested view.
Sure.
Interestingly, there are, call them dueling studies on this issue all over the country. Unfortunately, most of those, if not all of them, are being done by people who have vested interest on both sides of this issue, meaning charter school opponents are doing studies, charter school advocates are doing studies. I think readers and audiences should be very cautious in terms of where studies come from as they look at this, and they should try to find groups that are completely independent and that their funding on their studies is completely independent. One of the things I will tell you is, are there charter schools that aren't doing the job they should? Absolutely. But I will go back to my point. Those charters will lose their charters. And the charter school community has built-in accountability, and that's a good thing. The other thing you have to pay attention to is the 1 million families in the United States that have voted with their feet. And 1 million families have said, we think this particular charter school is better for our child, and they didn't have to make. I mean, that was a free choice on their part to make.
We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Chris Whittle. One time was owner of Esquire magazine, also the founder of Whittle Communications and Channel One. In 1991, he conceived and founded Edison Schools. They now serve more than 270,000 students in 20 states. And as I have mentioned, it is the largest for-profit manager of public schools in the United States. He has a book out that's outlined some of his ideas for reform of public education, how school systems and schools could be designed to do better. The title of the book is Crash Course, Imagining a Better Future for Public Education, published by Riverhead Books. We have some other callers here. We'll go next to somebody on a cell phone, line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Where do I start? Mr. Whittle, how can I say this? You've managed to whittle yourself down from one scheme to another, putting televisions and satellites in all classrooms. That seems to have gone passé. Now you're into, how should we say it, private school management. Your contention that if you cut the class size in half doesn't apply by doubling the class size or whatever. You got to remember the college high school seniors are a self-selected group. By that time, the ones who are dropping out have dropped out. They are more responsible by the time they're high school seniors. And by the time they're college freshmen, they're even more self-selected, and they're even more motivated. So, of course, they can do more work on their own. You're ignoring the fact that a good chunk of those motivated, sometimes distracted college freshmen will drop out. But in our school system, we don't have the luxury of letting these people just drop by the wayside and drop out and join their father's business or become beer distributors or whatever when their college athletic careers don't play out or whatever. How are you going to manage these people?
Well, let's begin here. I'm going to start by having a very optimistic view of what children are capable of. And I believe that our children are capable of far more than what our current school designs in the United States give them credit for. And that if we would give them the chance, and in many respects not bore them to tears, that they would perform at levels that might surprise us all. This is not something that a new school design cannot just be introduced like a light switch on and off. It's something we have to work with children on, and they've got to be part of it over many years. And I'll give you an example on this whole question of whether children can learn independently in a school setting. I'm not saying that we just walk in one day and say, okay, half of your time is on your own and half is in your classes. What the book actually proposes is that starting in elementary school, we start introducing students to a portion of their day, maybe very early grades. It's 30 minutes that they're going to spend on their own, and they're supervised perhaps by an older student. By the way, that's another page we take from colleges. We call them graduate students. And if you look at the role that graduate students play in colleges, it's immense. Why can't an eighth grader be, in effect, a prefect in an elementary school and play a similar role? Eighth graders babysit completely alone in homes all across the United States. In the safety of a school, I'm sure they could do it well while students were working on their own a bit. So we introduce it a little bit in the early grades, and we slowly increase it across many years. And we get one other huge benefit from a design like this. One of the most important qualities we want children in America and everywhere to develop is the ability to work independently and to think for themselves, to organize themselves. And if we never allow them to do that through 12 or 13 years of school experience, what we're doing is for those few that, not few, but for those 70% that do make it through, they haven't learned that particular skill, which is crucial to their success.
Caller, do you want to follow up? I guess the caller left. And I do have some other people we'll get to. Let me ask you a question, and forgive me, this doesn't really intended to be a hostile question, but I'm interested in having you talk about where you think Edison is now, because certainly the company has had its ups and downs from the point when it was publicly traded with a stock that was worth close to $37 a share. That was in the winter of 2001, to the point in fall of 2003 where it was worth 14 cents. And after this very bruising battle in Philadelphia over taking over schools there, you had to take the company private. I think there were some people at the time who thought maybe Edison would just go out of business.
I would go further. Some wished.
Well, it's true, and to this day, I'm sure that there are people in various communities who think that they are not real happy with the Edison schools and feel that in fact they're paying more. The cost of education has gone up; they're paying more, and they're not getting any more for it than they did before. So I know you have, I'm sure you have supporters, but I know that you have a lot of detractors. Where do you think that Edison stands right now?
Well, let's start in the city where we have the most schools, and the one that when we arrived there had the most controversy, which is Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, the state of Pennsylvania took over the Philadelphia Public Schools, and they asked Edison to take on the 20 most troubled schools in the city of Philadelphia. And let's remember where those schools were. 96% of all of the children in those schools were failing. 96%. And by the way, had been doing so for a decade, meaning if you looked at those schools over the last 10 years, that's the way it had been. 96% failure rate. We have lost our sense of outrage in the United States on this issue. People of power and privilege do not understand what is happening in so many schools out there. I live in New York City today. There are 13 schools in New York City that have a 100% failure rate. Not one child passed the state exams. Just think about that for a moment. No one is passing in 13 schools. And so in Philadelphia, we were asked, come in, and we'd like you to work with these schools and see if you can take them to a different level. In 36 months, we have quadrupled the passing rate. We've taken it from 4% to 28%. Now, you'll say, well, that still means we've got 72% that aren't there. And I would go, you're right, and we have a huge amount of work to go. But in those 36 months, we were able to move that passing rate in a way that it not even compared to what the 10 years before was. So I think academically across the United States, we're doing a very good job. We hope to do even better. We do have schools where we aren't doing well. This is extremely difficult work. Financially, for 14 years, we lost money. And I think our credentials that we are not a get-rich-quick scheme are impeccable, meaning we invested $675 million before we made our first dollar. And I think that shows that we put learning in front of earning. A small piece of good news on the financial front is we just made, in our 14th year, our first profit. It was tiny, but it was in the right direction. Mm.
Well, we have some other callers here. Let's get to them, and we'll go next to Urbana, line one. Hello.
There was a marvelous program on WYLL's companion TV station on Wednesday night, and I see that it's running again. It's already been repeated twice, but it's running again at 3 a.m. on Sunday for those who can get our station. It's called Making Schools Work, and I thought it was fascinating. There were some detailed examples of school reforms that have been working and quite a few different tacks taken. All of them have to do with implementing reforms that help kids learn, but in the process also reduce or eliminate behavior problems. And I just thought it was a marvelous program. I'm going to tape it, and I'm going to hand it to one school board member and say, please share this, and pay attention to whether or not it's possible to buy other copies. I think, although it says that it's that these various reforms have closed achievement gaps for minority and poor students, I would say that there are kids who don't, you don't have to be poor to have a school not work for you, and they just had some really, really interesting things, different people, different solutions, and I highly recommend it. Thanks a bunch. If you happen to know whether the, or can find out, and whether this is available for people to buy, that would be nice to have announced. Thanks.
I would, and I would expect that if you called to our TV station that somebody there should be able to tell you that. I couldn't tell you that right off. But
just a quick comment. I completely agree with the caller. I was actually on a program in Washington a couple of days ago with a producer of the show, and I think it's called Making Schools Work, and it is rerunning again. It is a good survey of a number of different improvement strategies that are working across the U.S.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign next, this line number three. Hello.
Yes, I'm wondering if you could give us your reaction or your thoughts on achievement-based schooling as opposed to this age-based maturity-level schooling that we have now. Particularly if instead of having grades 1 through 5 based on years 7 through 10 or 11, we had grades based on where the kids are academically in different subjects. I recall as a student excelling in the sciences and maths, for instance, and having a terrible time with spelling and English. And I wonder if we couldn't work out a system where we had youth working with other kids, no matter their age, at least within some parameter, on topics at a level that they could work at. And if you could just give us your reaction to that.
First of all, there are a couple of programs in the United States that are... Am I still on?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There are a couple of programs in the United States that are doing a terrific job of what the caller just mentioned. And we use one of them in all of the schools that we're engaged in. And what they do is they're constantly monitoring, and the particular program we use is a reading program. The teacher's constantly monitoring how children are doing and then regrouping them into groups, not permanent groups, but kind of a group might only stay together for 6 or 8 weeks. And depending on students may be getting a particular topic quicker or not, and then we regroup them periodically depending on how that's happening. The particular program we're using is used in about 900 schools across the U.S. It's out of Johns Hopkins University. It's called Success for All. And there are other examples in other subject areas, and lots of good schools use those techniques.
Someone clearly listening on the Internet here calling from San Francisco. We'll go there on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, morning. About 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, Edison was working hard to take over, I guess it was their first attempt in San Francisco, and they actually tried to confuse it by taking over the Thomas Edison School so that the neighbors wouldn't quite realize that this was a profiteering aspect of trying to manage the schools. But it led to the downfall of the superintendent of schools because of a bribery attempt. He went on to, before his reputation was entirely sullied around the rest of the nation, he went down to Dallas where he attempted to put Edison into the Dallas school system. They found out about his bribery and the bribery attempt by the Edison Project. And so he eventually lost his reputation, and Dallas lost a good deal of money because they had to pay out a huge golden parachute to him. So it's good to hear that their stock prices went down to 14 cents from wherever it was, but it's really unfortunate that this guy's not in prison for essentially doing the music man around the world, around the country, and essentially looting the school districts, bad-mouthing the attempts of communities to run their school districts on their own. If you look at the scam in the largest scale, for example, George Bush's brother Neil owns the testing system that George Bush is trying to force everybody's all the school districts to use. So these people used their bully pulpit to badmouth the school districts. Then, with that bully pulpit, they forced the school districts to buy testing programs that they own. And then, of course, they rise and fall depending on bribes that they pass out. So this is an ugly thing, and I wish the police were outside your studio to arrest this guy and put him in prison where he belongs.
Well, Mr. Whittle, you want to respond to the caller?
Yes, there were so many distortions in that 3 minutes that I could take the rest of the call addressing each. But here's one that I would simply say is that I would encourage anyone that's listening to visit our school in San Francisco to let you know how good it is. The state of California sided with us in the dispute that the caller mentioned. Actually took away the school from the school district of San Francisco and said, we want this to be an Edison school, and it's a terrific school, and has been outperforming the state and the city for some years now, and parents are in love with the site.
We are getting close to the end of the time. I want to get at least one more caller. We'll go to Champaign County. This will be line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I'm not sure if your guest is trying to duck the question, but could you actually specifically talk about the salaries in your system, that is the novice, junior, and senior teachers, and follow it up with your tuition structure? Thanks.
First of all, we have no tuition. We are a every school that Edison works with is a public school. Children go free to the school. There's no admissions requirement, meaning we're required by law to take any child that arrives, just like regular public schools do. So we don't have a tuition. And oftentimes people confuse the fact that we're a private company, that we're running private schools. We don't run private schools. We operate only in public schools. On the question of teacher compensation, we do have what we call a differentiated concept in our schools on teacher compensation, and we have, for example, a position in most Edison schools that's called lead teacher. And a lead teacher runs what we call a house, which is a group of about four classes in which about 80 or 100 students will typically be. And that lead teacher works as, think of them as the player coach, and they work with the other three or four teachers in the house. And they do receive extra compensation for doing that. And I commented earlier on the show that our teacher compensation is typically similar, maybe slightly above what you would see in public schools in the cities where we operate.
Hey, last question. Testing and standards, are you guys guided by the same platform of standards that every other school is in the district?
Yes. Edison schools have to operate under the same assessment regulations and requirements as any public school in the state that they're in. And what that means is in each state, whether it's ISTEP or ISAT or CSAP or API, we're doing all of those various things according to state regulations. And then we're also governed by all the same federal regulations, a la the NCLB Act. So we live with those in our schools.
Another point earlier on in the show, I'm not sure if you were, I don't know, you didn't really come out and really kind of say this, but I think, I mean, it's clear, it's not rocket science, come on. We know that there's a socioeconomic bias with all of this. Failure rates, kids staying in school, kids staying out of school, kids not performing. Before you end the show, can you just basically agree with that premise or that fact?
I'm not. Would you restate your question so I'm sure I understand it?
Yeah. Student performance overall in the general population is strictly tied to the socioeconomic background from whence the student comes.
It's well known in and documented, you know.
I guess I'm just trying to see what you're doing different. You know, I mean, it's...
Yeah, it is. I was about to respond. It is well known and well documented that there is an achievement gap in the United States. It's one of the terrible tragedies in education, and that is that children of color, if you look at the averages across the United States, do not have the same achievement rates or gains as white children in the United States. One of the things we are most thrilled about here at Edison is the rate of gain for children of color in our schools is actually greater than the rate of gain of white children, and we've really cracked the code on achievement gap across the 157 schools where we work.
Well, I just have to disagree with the corporatization of the public school system. There's a lack of political will, and I'll just close on that remark. Thanks.
All right. Well, we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. There's a lot more, I'm sure, that we could talk about in terms of design. You certainly have touched on what is, for you, I know, a key idea, that is independent learning. Students spend more time learning on their own, working on their own. That way you can have fewer teachers and in the process increase the pay of the teachers. But also, I'm sure that the idea of independent learning you think is an important one for its own sake.
Independent learning within a school setting.
Right.
Which, by the way, is quite different from homeschooling. as an example. And one of the things I'll say, and I understand how this happens, but we touched on only one aspect of what schools of the future ought to look like. I will say I think we touched on one of the most important, which is higher teacher pay and brought about by some independent learning. But the real reason I did the book is to talk about what schools of the future can look like and should look like. And I'll close, because I think you want me to close.
We pretty much have to, yeah.
Yeah. America believes there's only one school design, and it's the one we all went to. And what this book tries to do is open the eyes of readers and say, you know what, maybe there are many different ways we can do this, and that we'd be better off if we had some of those.
Well, more is to be found in the book. If people would like to see more of what Chris Whittle has to say, what he thinks about school design, look for the book. It's titled Crash Course, Imagining a Better Future for Public Education. That's the subtitle. It's published by Riverhead Books. Our guest, Chris Whittle, is the founder of Edison Schools. It is the nation's largest for-profit manager of public schools. Mr. Whittle, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
This program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates. This year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary, Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta, located at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus 580. Of course, we'll be back on Monday, but right now we want you to stay tuned because there'll be much more in the way of news, feature, sports, weather, other things coming up all as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, dog trainers Jim Keel and Carol Lindholm will join us. Jim and Carol are with the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana. They'll join us following the 1 o'clock news to answer our questions about dog care, behavior, training, and the like. That's coming up this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat is trading at 338.5, down 6.75. March, 352.5, down 6.75. December corn, 203, down 1.25. March, 215.75, down 1.25. May, 223.75, down 1.25. December corn, 246.75, down 1.25. November beans, 565. Make that 566, latest tick, up 1.75. January, 577.5, up 1. March, 585.5, up 2.